I'm going to do is I'm going to share my testimony, obviously, and that's I'm not a preacher, I'm not a theologian by any means, but I do have a story, and it does work for me. So, if you listen carefully, I'm going to do something at the end, and we'll give away a few tickets. How's that sound? Yeah. I know it's expensive to get off this island and on it, but I can help you a little ways. Anyways, it might be motivation to leave the island. How often do you guys get off the island here? Like monthly? Half a year? Hardly ever. Okay. Well, I hardly ever get here. So my long journey started on Friday, and I went the wrong way. I went to Horseshoe Bay. I didn't go to, what's the other place called? Tawasin. So I went the other way and had to wait 3 hours or so, but in that waiting, I got to, I'm pretty relaxed, and I know that God's got something great for me if when I'm waiting, and what he had this time for me was the best burger I've ever had. it was really good, and so it took us, we left Abbotsford around, I think 10, 11 o'clock, and we got into town about 6:37 around there. So it was quite a journey, but I was really, really glad to talk to the youth, and I want to say that, man, the kids around that table, it was beautiful. You guys are doing a good job with the kids. Most of them aren't here today, but that's okay. But I just saw some real good hope, some good questions, and of course, hanging out with Elias, and Isaiah. It's really nice to see how well they're put together right now. I'm not sure if you guys see that, but I do. So, my story. So it starts. Remember, you got to pay attention, right? There's motivation. So I was born in India, in a small village, probably less than 1,000 people, less than the amount of people that are on the island here. And I was born in a village called Gumti. So it's Gum and T. You spell it G-U-M-T-I. Punjab, India. You know what I'm doing. I was born in a barn. I was born in a barn beside cattle, all that stuff. The only thing I don't have exactly like Jesus is I wasn't put in a manger after. I probably had a pretty comfortable space, but yeah, I was born in a barn, and you know, all through my life, I do leave doors open, and people ask me that, and I say yes, I was born in a barn. So they can't do a lot about that. I'm the third child of five boys, so I'm the middle child. I got that negative middle child thing going for me right away. We lived in India. I was born in 74. And I was there for 2 years, and then we immigrated to Blairmore, Alberta. If any of you know where that is, you do. How do you know?
I used to live in Alberta for a long time.
Oh, yeah. So we lived right by the Frank Slide there. And we immigrated there. My dad worked in the coal mines and did quite well for himself. We owned three homes. Well, my dad owned three homes. And we just got into life there, went to elementary school, skated on the frozen creeks and running around, have a good life. But the major thing of my life that happened is in Blairmore, my birth mom passed away from cancer. It's so foggy. Our family didn't talk about it. There was no counseling. it was just kind of a shut door thing. And her side of the family didn't come around because they thought they might catch cancer from being around her, which we know that can't happen now. But back then, I guess there was lots of ignorance around that. So, and in Blairmore, my third brother, but the fourth boy was born, and that's the last one from my birth mom. And so shortly after that, after my mom passed away, my dad lost his job in the coal mine. And lost the houses, lost everything. So you can imagine this, a guy, I can barely handle one boy, as you could probably see this morning. I can barely handle one boy. He had four of us, probably the same energy, probably driving him nuts. So he very quickly got married again, and I call her my second mom, because she's been a great mom to me. There's no mother issues. There's nothing like that. Shortly after my dad lost his job and all that, we moved to Cranbrook, B.C. Anybody know of Cranbrook? Yeah, we lived there for a little while, and after about, a year and a half, 2 years, my dad went into life insurance and did Amway, and that stuff didn't work out, so we moved further to Abbotsford. There was a huge farming community, and that's where we came from. My whole generation, we've been farmers, so we came out there, and we began to work in the berry fields, and to get us on our feet, we actually lived in these small cabins, didn't have a home. There's probably about 20 to 30 people in this kind of community, shared kitchen, shared everything. And we lived there for a little while and worked our way up and worked hard. And my dad built a life for us. And elementary school was quite normal. So the door had been kind of just totally shut on this major thing in my life that's happened. But we just moved on. And I didn't really question it. Didn't really get a whole lot from my dad. I even to this day, I haven't had a full conversation around that. I've tried. My dad can't get through it, so I've decided within myself to just, you know, leave it with the Lord. And so, grade 7, started playing basketball, rugby, baseball, all these sports, and football, and all that, and had a really regular life, and you know, had lots of friends around me. Played the many sports and even got involved in school plays, and my grades were just whatever. They've always been that way. Don't listen to that, kids. Get good grades. And then I had my first drink in grade 7. We were at my friend's family kind of yearly barbecue they do, and his dad would give him a drink, and then I took a sip, and I didn't like it. And things kind of went on to grade 8. And in grade 8, I was a part of student council. I was very involved with school, and I knew all these good things, but I kept on experimenting with marijuana, with alcohol here and there, beers here and there. And that continued throughout high school, grade 8 to 10. Probably smoked a little bit more weed, and then continued that. And then grade 12 came, and all throughout this, it would seem that every time I would use drugs or alcohol, that theme of, you know, questions about my mom would come up, especially when you were coming off the drugs. It would be even more of a more questions of that coming up. So I didn't really ask anybody. I just kind of internalized everything. And then in grade 12, graduated high school barely. They had to take they took 2 credits from grade 9 typing and some other class, and they said, "We'll give you those. Go on your way," because the teachers liked me a lot, and I would even be allowed to miss class to go practice for the game. Like, basketball was huge in our school. We had this rivalry with MEI. They're another school in Abbotsford, and there'd be a couple thousand people out to these games, and so they would let me just miss class to go practice for the big game. And I don't know if that was right, but it worked for me. So we graduated high school, and I think that's where things started getting deeper and worse. And in grade 12, graduating barely, kind of friends are moving on, and I'm just going deeper into experimenting with different drugs, and they're going to university. I could have played college basketball easily, I think, you know. A lot of my friends that I play with did, but I chose a different path. And eventually, at the age of 22, friends of mine were going to a Depeche Mode concert. Does anybody know Depeche Mode?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah. Yes. I still don't mind their music. It's a little depressing, but that's why I liked it then, because I actually was depressed. My friends that I went with, they pulled out some cocaine, and we were on our way. And that's where the beginning of the end started for me. Throughout all this, my first experience with God would have been in grade 7. I went to a youth group type of thing. It wasn't on Friday nights. I think it was on Saturdays, and we'd play volleyball. We'd do all kinds of things. And one day, one of the leaders pulled me to the side. He said, "So this Jesus thing, what do you think? And do you want to do the prayer?" And in my grade 7 mind, I'm thinking, "Oh, I better do the prayer. Well, I can't play volleyball anymore." So I actually said the prayer then, which is really powerful. If you think of what some of the word says, and I got a verse at this point for that, and it's Romans 10:9-10. If you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For it is with your heart that you believe and are justified, and it is with your mouth that you profess your faith and are saved. So at that day in grade 7, I did confess with my mouth, but I had no belief in my heart. But that was going to line up soon enough. So that was spoken out, and that's how powerful the word is, right? It's spoken, and it does its thing. It takes some time. Sometimes it takes 25 years or so. So from 22, from that first time I used cocaine, we'd go to special occasions, and the same friends would be around. So it would be special occasions using cocaine. And sorry if this offends anybody that I'm saying the actual name of the drugs, but I think it's helpful. It would end up special occasions, you know, birthdays and all that stuff, Christmas, and then it would be every weekend, and eventually it was every day, before work, after work. And at the time, I always knew I had a problem. It was, and I never ever thought the problem was the people that I was hanging out with. It was always me. So it's one of the things I've always realized, and that I pass on now, is that the problem is actually me. It's actually you. You got to figure out the you problem first before you can point it everywhere else. And so it progressed. 1998 was a big year. 1998, 99, 2000. Those years, I was really getting into it with family, fights with my oldest brother, just other kinds of stuff. The chaos that comes along with drugs, it was all coming up, so it came to a kind of a head point where I said, "Forget it, I'm jumping in my car." And at this point, I hadn't dealt drugs or anything like that, but somebody asked me to do something with about a pound of weed, and I did it. So it didn't work out that great. So I said, "Forget it, I'm taking off to Ontario," and I drove straight. I was high the whole way, and I had an uncle out there, so I thought getting away will help me with my problem. But the only problem that I took with me was myself, and myself followed me all the way. It didn't leave me the whole way. So my problems continued there. I was there for about a year and a half. And out there, what they do is they would take marijuana, and they would take crack cocaine, and they mix it together and smoke it. And I did that, and I liked that a lot. And then one day, one of my cousin's friends said, "Hey, why don't you take this and just smoke it straight, the cocaine?" And I did that, and it was over. That was it. I never did any other drugs after that other than crack cocaine. That's how highly addictive it was. And I lost everything out there. I was engaged out there as well. I met a girl and was engaged. That went south really quick. And so I ended up coming back. I phoned my dad, and my dad always bailed me out of everything, which if I look back, he probably should have stopped that a long time ago. That's the only thing that was going to help me. But he bailed me out, got me back to Abbotsford, and I found all the wrong people right away because I'm the wrong person, and began to just use even deeper. I'd done some things, like gone away to India for a while. But in India, I wouldn't use the hard drugs I was using there. I'd just use the drugs that were there. So, again, I went out there for 6 months. I remember even in year 2000, flying back from Y2K. I was in the air on New Year's Eve and came right back and drove home to Abbotsford, and then drove out to Vancouver for a New Year's party, and it was just craziness. These types of things were always going on, and you know, eventually I started stealing from my family because I couldn't hold a job. I started stealing cash from my mom, selling things that I could, and they had an intervention at home. And my brothers and everybody said, "Hey, Dad, you gotta just. If he does this again, you can't bail him out." So my dad actually did that. I remember nights upon nights after I was done using, phoning my dad and asking if I'd come home. He would say no, and he stuck to it. So what that did is that made me go even deeper. So now I'm homeless in Abbotsford for about a year or so, staying in over 24-hour coffee shops in those bank machine things, because I still have bank cards, so I'd open those and I'd sleep in them. And even just staying up for like days and days on end, and then catching an hour of sleep, and then going back to using, going stealing. I was pretty bold. I think God is using that now. But I was pretty bold with even, you know, I would set it up with the dealers. I'd ask them what they wanted from the liquor store. They'd tell me. I'd just go in, grab it, and leave, and trade off. So I didn't even need money for my drugs. It wasn't anything like that. Another thing that I had that I didn't do is I never begged anybody for money. I just went and made it happen myself, which all these things are really positive now, because I go make things happen now. But they're all really good things, most of them. So I went deeper. I ended up robbing a pizza place, and then after that, a few nights later, I robbed a gas station where I just walked in and said, "Give me your money," like this. And then the guy would be like, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, just give me your money. Give me your money that you got there." And he said things like, I didn't use profanity. I just said, "Hey, just calmly give me your money." And he asked me, "Well, what do you have? What do you have on you? Are you going to hurt me?" I said, you don't want to find out. And I wasn't going to do nothing because I was scared. But I did that, ended up going even deeper, if you could think of it. And like it's always kind of challenging on what to share on how deep, but just if you know this disease, this thing that I went through and that I still have to be mindful of, there's some pretty depths that it can go to, even as far as where you hang out and what you do, crack shacks and all that kind of stuff. It was horrible. None of it was good. None of anything I'm sharing with you is meant to be, you know, "Wow, look at this, you know, amazing story." But the next part is, the next part is the part you want to grab onto and be encouraged and have hope. So on Friday, the message was a warning. Today it's hope. You may be sitting there going, "Man, I know somebody." You may be sitting there going, "Man, I was Cal," or you may be just going through some of it yourself, which is okay. There is hope. So I was walking the streets in Clearbrook Road, and the police officers that would often talk to me and arrest me and all these things. I had been in and out of jail a lot of times. One night out. They would always say to me, "Cal, what are you doing? You don't belong out here. Get some help." And one day, the same police officers came by and they said, "Cal, what are you doing out here?" And I said, "You know what? I'm done. I said, "This is what I did. I robbed this gas station." And what they said was, they said, "Well, we thought it was you, but the description was 5'9", 5'10", East Indian male, with a shaved head." And if you ever visited Abbotsford, that could be a number of people. So they couldn't quite pin it on me. So I got arrested and I went to a place called North Fraser Pretrial Center. That's where they hold you before you go for your actual trial. And that's where life kind of began for me again. And up to this point, numerous arrests, over probably about 20, some for assault, some for stealing, some for breaching, some for all these different things. And in that, I also had about about 7 drug-induced seizures. So that's where you use so much of the drug that you actually go into a seizure state. And God just saved me out of all that. I shouldn't actually be able to stand here. I shouldn't be able to talk. I shouldn't be able to produce kids or be married or anything. And I have 3 kids. I have 1 on the way in July. So God is pretty good. And I got arrested. So I went into North Fraser, and it was a pretty scary environment. But I found my, just like anywhere where I went, I found my group, and I found my way. And I'm doing things like playing basketball and working out and playing cards. And in jail, you play cards for kind of canteen or these different things. And I'm a pretty happy guy. I've always been on the face, pretty happy guy. So we were winning a lot of canteen, and I was pretty happy about it. But the people that we were winning from, they weren't too happy. And they weren't too happy at all. And nobody wants a really happy guy in jail or a really sad guy. They just want you to be like, you know, I'm just cool. I'm just going to hang out. And so they sent a guy into my jail cell to take care of me. And I remember he cracked me on top of the head, and I went back into my bunk. And the only thing that saved me was this thumb in the guy's eye, because that was the only way I was going to get out of it. And that retracted him, and he got out. But what I want to say to you is I saw true evil coming at me that day. And I recognized what evil was that day. And I got transferred out of there. And when I checked in, I picked up a Quran. I picked up the Sikh scriptures in English, because I can't read Punjabi, but I can speak it a bit. Well, fluently at home, but a bit in the traditional sense. And I picked up the Bible as well. So I'll stop right there and just say that my brother Bindu Sidhu, he's a pastor in Abbotsford. He went through what I went through really quick. Like really quick, he got involved in robberies, and there was a murder in Abbotsford. He wasn't the guy who pulled the trigger or anything, but they used his gun. So he did it really quick, and he came out of it. And God, in a jail cell, he said, "Hey, you're mine. Come on, let's go." And in matter of fact, when they got arrested, he's in the car, and his buddy's robbing the convenience store, and he says, "God, if you're real, stop this." And no sooner did a police car pull up and stopped it and arrested them. They were on their way. He has the rest of that story, but it's just powerful how God works. And I would say that my brother and I went through the same things. He just went through a little bit quicker. And praise God, he's been serving for 22 years as a pastor or in ministry, but most of them as a pastor. So and this is 2006 now when I got arrested. This is 2006 when that evil comes at me. And so in my next bunk at night, I knew I had to do something. I knew I had to. So I picked up the Bible, and I began to read from Matthew. And the cool thing about this part is that I'm reading, and I have no knowledge or anything, nothing. And I'm reading the book of Matthew, and it's got the perfect lineage of Christ here, and it's telling exactly who Christ is. And I've heard of Jesus, of course, but it's got the lineage and where he comes from. And God's given me perfect understanding for that moment to testify to me through his word. Nobody else around, just me and his word. And as I'm understanding, the words are coming. They're starting to dictate themselves to me in a miraculous way. And pretty soon I'm just here, and the word is telling me, this is my son, this is who it is, and he's real. And finally, I just put the book down. I said, "Jesus, I know you're real." I said, "Come change my life." And he did. He started there. It's continuing to work today, but I know that we all have that journey. But my journey of hope started then. And what had happened right at that moment was I had the perfect revelation of who Jesus was. Nobody else, you couldn't even tell me anything beyond that day of who he is. And and what he represents beyond what the word told me to myself. But there was still a lot, and I explained it that I had the revelation that day, but the foundation was definitely not there. So the next morning, the prison chaplain there was really, really awesome, a guy named Dan Boo. Does anybody know Dan? That would be awesome if somebody knew Dan Boo. he's awesome. So when I got in, he gave me the Sikhs wear a bracelet that's not supposed to rust. He gave me these books to read. He gave me all this stuff. He just said, here you go, because he recognizes that a spiritual journey, often it doesn't just start with the Bible. It doesn't start with Christ. It often goes through some other things before it gets there. That same bracelet I had, as these fights, as these games were happening, was beginning to rust. So it was kind of just these signs of God reaching out, and through even the religious symbols from my past, just kind of reaching out. But he got together with me. We phoned my brother the next day, and my brother, at this time, very time, was going in front of, we're part of an MB conference church. He was going in front of like 1,500 people to speak and to talk about a new church plant. So the church I'm involved right now was being planted when I was, like, right when I was being saved too. So I'm still a part of that church. And he phoned me, and we said the prayer to receive Christ. Although I said it in grade 7, and I got the revelation in a jail cell, we felt like we had to just, I really wanted to honor my brother by doing that with him. Some people say, yeah, your brother saved you, hey? No. No, he didn't. He never will. I enjoy that misconception. I enjoy saying that, no, he didn't. So jail continued. I was still, did the prayer revelation, everything. And Dan had me involved in Sunday church, and we began the purpose-driven life. That was a huge thing to me, and I knew that God had a very purpose for my life by learning through that book. A few guys came to know Christ through being my jailmate, and so that was kind of neat. I never experienced that before, but again, they didn't do it. They didn't get there because of me. It's the Lord that did that too, right? This is about 45 days in. I had about 45 days left, give or take a few days. And things changed for me, but a lot of the things that I was doing was very much the same. There was no real opportunity to teach me in there. So one of the next major things was we had to go in front of the judge next. And that was a nerve-wracking time. I remember praying, God, I don't want to lie. I don't want to go in front of the court and lie about what I did. I was going to tell the truth about that robbery. And if they had convicted me, I would have got about 2.5 years in prison, which I didn't get convicted of it. As I was in the holding cell waiting to go in front of the judge, the Crown Counsel came down and said, "Hey, if you plead guilty to one day breach of what you've did before while you were on an order, then we'll just let you go." I said, "You're just gonna let me go?" So, because I'm ready to go in front and tell the truth. "Nope, you don't want to do that." That's the Crown Counsel saying, "Nope, you don't want to do that." Okay, God. I won't do that. God's done different things to get people out of jail. He just shakes the whole place, and people get released, right? So why not? why not work through that guy? I got released from jail, and the prison chaplain, Dan Boo, he asked me to come live with him. Which is it's pretty unheard of. It's just not right. And I say bless him, but I say bless his wife even more, because she had to agree with that, right? Having some guy from prison, and I think I treated people okay even before Christ. I wouldn't really harm anybody per se, but yeah, he had me come live with him. And I got a good job at the local paper in classified section, selling classified ads, and things were really good. But this is the time when I discovered what was really missing. I did not have that foundation, and And I had the revelation, no foundation. But I also discovered, as far as what my mom's death kind of meant to me, it meant to me a rejection. And I actually, in my discovery at Wagner Hills Ministries, that's where I now serve, and there's a recovery ministry for anywhere from 40 to 50 guys at any time. And when I was there, I stayed there for a year and graduated the program. And what I got to learn in there was to identify this rejection piece and why, what was going on with me every time something kind of weird happened in my life. I got to really discover that. So just before I went in there, I had met a girl, and I liked her in a way, and I told her, and then she didn't like me the same way, but she still wanted to hang out with me for some reason. I don't know why. But I guess she felt called to me, but we all know that it's probably a man that should have been called to me. But she did help me learn a big lesson. And so what happened is, when she rejected me, had this great job at the news, I went back into my default, which was using crack cocaine. So I did that for 3 weekends in a row. And finally I told Dan and I told my brother, I said, this is what's going on. And they took me and we went to a place in Langley called a church called CLA. They had a recovery ministry there, and I knew that wasn't enough for me to go there once a week, or I needed something more in depth. And that's when I went into Wagner Hills, and in Wagner Hills is when I discovered the foundation in my life. I discovered my new identity in Christ, which is powerful. It's a powerful thing, even for us that are walking and doing regular life every day. We lose the sense of that sometimes if we don't get reminded. I think there's over 25 scriptures that tell you who you are. So I got to do a big discovery over that year. And in that year, I was the only one to graduate. And I seen like 500 different guys coming through. So God had that type of thing for me too. And I got involved in the counseling office, which after about 6 months or so, they give you a kind of a leadership role, and I didn't want it. I just wanted to be there to get what I needed, and I needed to get out of there. So the day I could leave, I did. And then life kind of continued after that. I graduated the program and got another job at another newspaper, but this was a higher role than I had before. Worked steady for a while, in 2008, around there, I told the youth on Friday about just wanting to meet my wife. I just wanted to get this next stage of life going. So I went to these dating sites because I wanted to meet a Christian girl. So I went to Christian Cafe. There's some other ones, and I met these girls, and every time I would go for a date, I'd just be like, what? I'm like, God, that doesn't make any sense. So I didn't like any of them. Because they weren't for me, but eventually I said, God, okay, this is what's happening, Lord, listen up, this is what's happening. That works really well, doesn't it? All the, every time it works really well. So I told him, and I said, Lord, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to work for this next year, and then I'm taking off. I'm going to go wherever you send me. But I said, God, if you do have someone for me, I need to know. I need to know exactly that it's from you. So I laid out a few things. I said, Lord, I want to meet her at the front doors of the church. I want to meet her through a friend. And then I want you to give me something that could only come from you, that would just blow me away. And I would, that's how I'd know. So God laughed at me first. And he said, it's okay, my son. If that's how you're going to believe in me, then I'll give it to you. He didn't say that, but maybe he was thinking that. At the Life Center, the church that I'm in now, we're coming up on 10 years in as a church. We started as a home church, and then we moved into a gymnasium. We're in a theater room first, so that was about this size, and then we moved to a gymnasium. Now we have our own church, but I've had various leadership roles there as well, whether it was doing the chairs, Sunday service chairs or all kinds of other things, sitting on leadership at the same time, but doing probably doing everything that I could to help the church. And one of my roles was Sunday. I was the Sunday service manager. So I would clean up after, and then I'd go outside, and the last thing we'd bring in is the sandwich boards. So I bring the sandwich boards. I come cleaning up, and Shonda's like, "Hey, Cal, come here. Come here, come here." And Shonda's a girl that planted the church with us. "Come here. This is Misty." So, "Hey, Misty, how's it going? Nice to meet you. Very nice to meet you." And front doors of the church through a friend. So that's two knocked off just like that. And I had asked her for a coffee, but she gave me the best answer that I've heard in a long time. She said, "I can't because I'm seeing somebody." I was like, it was a oh, but it was also a, huh, this is the type of girl that I want to meet. Because she's a lot of I was saying on Friday, a lot of women out that way, I'm not sure if they do it here, but they would still go for that coffee with a guy with me, right? Which wouldn't be right. The other thing, so what had happened when we met is the love thing, it does many things. And I asked once and I sat back and that's it. I noticed her over the next week or two, and eventually Shonda comes back to me, "Hey, Cal, you should ask her again because they broke up." So Shonda's awesome, and we're around each other, and we still see each other all the time. But so I ask her again, and she says yes, which is great. Yay! She says yes, and we went for a walk with her dog, and she has a Rottweiler, and it was a year, and I was scared of dogs, so that's how bad I wanted to be around her. Sometimes you gotta walk through fear to do that. So we went for a walk, and that same day we were like, we didn't want to be apart. We wanted to continue the date. So I said, "So let's go eat." Okay, let's go eat. Where do you want to eat? And we're humming and hawing this place, that place. I'm like, "Wherever you want, because I'm not picky." And she said, "Well, you want to just come to my parents' house?" "What? You want me to go to your parents' house for..." Okay. And so I said yes, and I pretty much knew right there that was... I knew it before, but... So I knew right there. And when we went out for our first real date, there was a moment where we just went like this. It wasn't kissing. It wasn't making out. Okay? It was this. And I felt this, like, just... powerful energy, and it was crazy. Just this was crazy. So yeah, then we fell in love. We fell in love really quickly. We knew within 2 weeks that we were going to marry each other. And she, matter of fact, she told her mom, which her mom told me that later, like a week later, she said, "Mom, I think I love this guy." Okay, we'll take that. So we fell in love really quick. We got engaged that. So we met in October. We got engaged that December, we got married that June. So 2008 December, and then June 2009 we got married, and the whole thing was really fast, and we didn't really get to know each other. We just knew that we were each other's. And the third thing that I asked God to do is just give me this huge thing that would just be like, boom, this is your wife. So he did. The prison chaplain, Dan Boo, that I lived with after being in jail for a while, we discovered that Misty actually lived with him when she was a toddler, a little baby. Well, that's pretty cool, eh? So she lived with them because her mom was having problems with her husband, and Misty was born a toddler around that time, so they went and lived with her, and that came up later. So I was like, okay. So anytime now when I think, oh man, you know, or even in the recent years, like, wow, this is really hard, Lord, this is really challenging, you know, he gets to laugh at me again and say, yeah, well, that's what I signed you up for there. So One of the big verses to me in my life, and it continues, is Philippians 1:6. And it says, being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Jesus Christ. My life has been not been easy since meeting my wife and getting married and all that stuff. We had a, and I gotta watch the time. I'm gonna have to run out of here soon to catch that next ferry. Yeah, but we're gonna see if we can get this done here. We got together, me and my wife were. I'm drinking wine again, I shouldn't have been doing anything. So I'm drinking wine again at dinner. Not at home. We didn't drink at home or nothing like that. But it kind of opened a door for when the next major thing in my life would happen. Was we were in 2010. We were pregnant. We're looking forward to having our first baby, and we had a miscarriage. So what happened at that time is I was really, really strong for her, but I didn't take care of myself. I didn't kind of go and talk to people and get any kind of counseling or any talk. I just was strong for her, and the first moment that it came about that for me to use again, I did, and I went looking for it. I just went. It wasn't like somebody offered it to me. But that was the last time I did use anything. It was in July 2010. It's been about 6 years now. Is that what it is? Yeah, 6 years, or who's counting, right? But God has been faithful through all that. Today we have three children. So there's Asher, who's here. He's popping up and down and doing his thing. He's four, and I have a daughter, Samara. She's three. I have another daughter, Nariah. She's 1.5. And then we have one coming in July. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and today I try to serve God and pay him back as much as I can. And I know I can, and he knows I can. But out of this deep desire to serve and be a part of what he's doing, I do as much as I can, and my wife says sometimes it's too much, and I try to listen to her. But I ask her to pray before she tells me that, because he might tell her something else. So that's a part of coming out here is one of the things I've kind of made up my mind with God, is that if you give me an opportunity, I'll just go. I'll just go talk, and I know that it does various things. And so today I do that. That's my number one role, is at home. For work, I work for a company called First Page Marketing, and we do websites and internet marketing. And I get to, and let me tell you, like I ministry isn't an on again off switch for me. I learned through various books. One is called God My Everything, and it's by Ken Shigematsu. He's a pastor in Vancouver, a Japanese pastor. It's a really good book. If it's God My Everything, it's a really good one. I would read that. So I do that, and my ministry at work, like I've been in meetings where I'm meeting people the first time, and they tell me about their sick child, and I just pray with them. I put everything aside and just do it. And I want to encourage you guys to, if you don't or do that or want to take the next step, just try it once. Spiritual gifts are for everybody. It depends which ones you practice. Those are the ones that really gain a lot of fruit. Another thing I do, I'm a director at Abbotsford Community Foundation, and we have endowment funds, and we give out scholarships of about 400,000. I think we're going to give out this year in Abbotsford to kids to get them to the next level. And the reason I do that is because I didn't do that part. So, but I know I can still help in that part, and I get to give out scholarships at schools. And last year I got to actually personally hand out like 60,000. It was awesome. It wasn't my money, so it was awesome. Here you go. Yeah, here you go. Anybody else want some? So that's another thing. And the reason I'm telling you all these things I do is not to be like, wow, look what I do. I just want you to know what God can do in a life if you allow him to. Those are the things officially I do. And then I do the Wagner Hills Ministries on Thursday nights. We lead worship and prayer. Now we're going on an outreach thing every second Thursday, so I'm taking the guys out. We do every couple weeks do a breakfast program at elementary school where I get to serve meals to these kids, and it's just amazing to watch their faces. And it's also heart-wrenching when you're done your food and that gate arrives late. Oh my goodness. There's no food left, right? So, those are my number one roles in the church right now at the Life Center. I've had to scale back quite a bit, as you can imagine, with having these kids. But I did just finish on the search team to find a new pastor. I don't know if you guys are actively looking for a pastor, but it was about a year and a half long process, which is I was done after 6 months. I was like, you guys, if we don't find him, and this is me telling God again, if we don't find him in 6 months, I need to step off this team. I need to move on, right? And but I stayed on, and we're putting a candidate forward right now, and it's a pretty exciting time. My brother pastored the church for 8 years, and then he resigned, and he now is a pastor of church planting and branch development at a larger church in Surrey called Calvary Worship Center. Do you guys know that church?
Yeah, I go there.
Yeah, you do? Yeah. All right. That's everything. I want to say that the life isn't perfect. Life is really good. Like, it's really good right now, but it's not perfect. I still have to go through the same things. This morning, I mean, of course, the devil would try to creep into my dreams, and I had a using dream this morning. So I had to do the First Corinthians 10:13 thing, and I had to do the Second Corinthians 10:5 thing. That's what I have to do with my thoughts, and that's what I have to do with what's coming on me. It's common to all men. That's what 10:13 says, and then Second Corinthians 10:5 says to take every thought captive and make it obedient to the will of Jesus Christ in your life, and that's for everybody. Like, those are like, if you can live in there, then it's a really good spot to live in. And I forget it when I'm going through stuff. For some reason I'll go like four hours living in this crud when I could just actually take care of it too. So I'm still working on it. Is it gonna be automatic one day? Anybody know that? Great. Okay. So that's my life.